Fourth and last part. Ah, where in the world have there been greater follies than with the pitiful? And what in the world has caused more suffering than the follies of the pitiful? Woe to all loving ones who have not an elevation which is above their pity. Thus spoke the devil to me once on a time. Even God has his hell. It is his love for man. And lately did I hear him say these words: God is dead. Of his pity for man has God died. Zarathustra 2, The Pitiful. Chapter 61, The Honey Sacrifice. And again passed moons and years over Zarathustra's soul, and he heeded it not. His hair, however, became white. One day, when he sat on a stone in front of his cave and gazed calmly into the distance, one there gazes out on the sea and away beyond sinuous abysses. Then went his animals thoughtfully round about him, and at last set themselves in front of him. "O Zarathustra," said they, "gazes you out perhaps for your happiness?" "Of what account is my happiness?" answered he. "I have long ceased to strive any more for happiness. I strive for my work." "O Zarathustra," said the animals once more, "that say you, as one who has overmuch of good things. Lie you not in a sky-blue lake of happiness?" "You wags," answered Zarathustra, and smiled. "How well did you choose the simile! But you know also that my happiness is heavy, and not like a fluid wave of water. It presses me, and will not leave me, and is like molten pitch." Then went his animals again thoughtfully around him, and placed themselves once more in front of him. "O Zarathustra," said they, "it is consequently for that reason that you yourself always become yellower and darker, although your hair looks white and flaxen. Lo, you sit in your pitch." "What do you say, mine animals?" said Zarathustra, laughing. "Verily, I reviled when I spoke of pitch. As it happens with me, so it is with all fruits that turn ripe. It is the honey in my veins that makes my blood thicker, and also my soul stiller." "So will it be, O Zarathustra," answered his animals, and pressed up to him. "But will you not today ascend a high mountain? The air is pure, and today one sees more of the world than ever." "Yea, mine animals," answered he, "you counsel admirably and according to my heart. I will today ascend a high mountain. But see that honey is there, ready to hand, yellow, white, good, ice cool, golden comb honey. For know that when aloft, I will make the honey sacrifice." When Zarathustra, however, was aloft on the summit, he sent his animals home that had accompanied him, and found that he was now alone. Then he laughed from the bottom of his heart, looked around him, and spoke thus: "That I spoke of sacrifices and honey sacrifices, it was merely a ruse in talking, and verily a useful folly. Here aloft can I now speak freer than in front of mountain caves and anchorites' domestic animals. What to sacrifice? I squander what is given me, a squanderer with a thousand hands. How could I call that sacrificing? And when I desired honey, I only desired bait, and sweet mucus and mucilage, for which even the mouths of growling bears and strange, sulky, evil birds water. The best bait as huntsmen and fishermen require it. For if the world be as a gloomy forest of animals and a pleasure ground for all wild huntsmen, it seems to me rather, and preferably, a fathomless rich sea, a sea full of many-hued fishes and crabs, for which even the gods might long, and might be tempted to become fishers in it, and caster of nets. So rich is the world in wonderful things, great and small, especially the human world, the human sea. Towards it do I now throw out my golden angle rod and say, 'Open up, you human abyss. Open up, and throw to me your fish and shining crabs. With my best bait shall I allure you to myself today, the strangest human fish. My happiness itself do I throw out into all places, far and wide, twixt Orient, Noontide, and Occident, to see if many human fish will not learn to hug and tug at my happiness. Until biting at my sharp hidden hooks, they have to come up to my height, the motliest abyss groundlings, to the wickedest of all fishers of men. For this am I from the heart and from the beginning, drawing, here drawing, upward drawing, upbringing, a drawer, a trainer, a training master, who not in vain counseled himself once on a time, become what you are. Thus may men now come up to me, for as yet do I await the signs that it is time for my downgoing. As yet do I not myself go down, as I must do, among men. Therefore do I here wait, crafty and scornful upon high mountains, no impatient one, no patient one, rather one who has even unlearnt patience, because he no longer suffers. For my fate gives me time. It has forgotten me, perhaps. Or does it sit behind a big stone and catch flies? And verily, I am well disposed to mine eternal fate, because it does not hound and hurry me, but leaves me time for merriment and mischief, so that I have today ascended this high mountain to catch fish. Did ever anyone catch fish upon high mountains? And though it be a folly what I here seek and do, it is better so than that down below I should become solemn with waiting and green and yellow, a posturing wrasnorder with waiting, a holy howlstorm from the mountains, an impatient one that shouts down into the valleys, "Hearken, else I will scourge you with the scourge of God." Not that I would have a grudge against such wrathful ones on that account. They are well enough for laughter to me. Impatient must they now be, those big alarm drums, which find a voice now or never. Myself, however, and my fate, we do not talk to the present, neither do we talk to the never. For talking, we have patience and time, and more than time. For one day must it yet come, and may not pass by. What must one day come and may not pass by? Our great Hazar, that is to say, our great remote human kingdom, the Zarathustra kingdom of 1,000 years. How remote may such remoteness be? What does it concern me? But on that account, it is none the less sure to me. With both feet stand I secure on this ground, on an eternal ground, on hard primary rock, on this highest, hardest, primary mountain ridge, to which all winds come, as to storm parting, asking where and whence and whither. Here laugh, laugh, my hearty, healthy wickedness. From high mountains cast down your glittering scorn laughter. Allure from me with your glittering the finest human fish. And whatever brings to me in all seas, my in and form me in all things, fish that out for me. Bring that up to me, for that do I wait, the wickedness of all fish catchers. Out, out, my fishing hook, in and down, you bait of my happiness. Drip your sweetest dew, you honey of my heart. Bite my fishing hook into the belly of all black affliction. Look out, mine eye. Oh, how many seas round about me, what downing human futures. And above me, what rosy red stillness, what unclouded silence. Chapter 62. The Cry of Distress. The next day sat Zarathustra again on the stone in front of his cave, while his animals roved about in the world outside to bring home new food, also new honey. For Zarathustra had spent and wasted the old honey to the very last particle. When he thus sat, however, with a stick in his hand, tracing the shadow of his figure on the earth and reflecting, verily, not upon himself in a shadow. All at once he startled and shrank back, for he saw another shadow beside his own. And when he hastily looked around and stood up, behold, there stood the soothsayer beside him, the same who he had once given to eat and drink at his table, the proclaimer of the great weariness who taught, all is alike, nothing is worthwhile. The world is without meaning, knowledge strangled. But his face had changed since then, and when Zarathustra looked into his eyes, his heart was startled once more. So much evil announcement and ashy gray lightnings passed over that countenance. The soothsayer, who had perceived what went on in Zarathustra's soul, wiped his face with his hand, as if he would wipe out the impression. The same did also Zarathustra. And when both of them had thus silently composed and strengthened themselves, they gave each other the hand as a token that they wanted once more to recognize each other. "Welcome here," said Zarathustra, "you soothsayer of the great weariness. Not in vain shall you once have been my messmate and guest. Eat and drink also with me today, and forgive it that a cheerful old man sits with you at table." "A cheerful old man," answered the soothsayer, shaking his head. "But whoever you are or would be, O Zarathustra, you have been here aloft the longest time. In a little while, your bark shall no longer rest on dry land." "Do I then rest on dry land?" asked Zarathustra, laughing. "The waves around your mountain," answered the soothsayer, "rise and rise, the waves of great distress and affliction. They will soon raise your bark also and carry you away." Thereupon was Zarathustra silent and wondered. "Do you still hear nothing?" continued the soothsayer. "Does it not rush and roar out of the depth?" Zarathustra was silent once more and listened. Then heard he a long, long cry, which the abysses threw to one another and passed on. For none of them wished to retain it, so evil did it sound. "You ill announcer," said Zarathustra at last. "That is a cry of distress, and the cry of a man. It may come, perhaps, out of a black sea. But what does human distress matter to me? My last sin, which has been reserved for me, know you what it is called?" "Pity," answered the soothsayer, from an overflowing heart, and raised both his hands aloft. "O Zarathustra, I have come that I may seduce you to your last sin." And hardly had those words been uttered, when there sounded the cry once more, and longer and more alarming than before, also much nearer. Hear you, O Zarathustra," called out the soothsayer. "The cry concerns you, it calls you. Come, come, come. It is time, it is the highest time." Zarathustra was silent thereupon, confused and staggered. At last he asked, like one who hesitates in himself, "And who is it that there calls me?" "But you know it certainly," answered the soothsayer warmly. "Why do you conceal yourself? It is the higher man that cries for you." "The higher man," cried Zarathustra, horror-stricken. "What wants he? What wants he? The higher man, what wants he here?" And his skin covered with perspiration. The soothsayer, however, did not heed Zarathustra's alarm, but listened and listened in the downward direction. When, however, it had been still there for a long while, he looked behind and saw Zarathustra standing, trembling. "O Zarathustra," he began with sorrowful voice, "you do not stand there like one whose happiness makes him giddy. You will have to dance, lest you tumble down. But although you should dance before me and leap all your side leaps, no one may say to me, 'Behold, here dances the last joyous man.' In vain would anyone come to this height who sought him here. Caves would he find, indeed, and back caves, hiding places for hidden ones, but not lucky mines, nor treasure chambers, nor new gold veins of happiness. Happiness! How indeed could one find happiness among such buried alive and solitary ones? Must I yet seek the last happiness on the happy isle and far away among forgotten seas? But all is alike. Nothing is worthwhile. No seeking is of service. There are no longer any happy isles." Thus sighed the soothsayer with his last sigh. However, Zarathustra again became serene and assured, like one who has come out of a deep chasm into the light. "Nay, nay, three times nay," exclaimed he with a strong voice, and stroked his beard. "That do I know better. There are still happy isles. Silence thereon, you sighing sorrow sack. Cease to splash thereon, you rain cloud of the forenoon. Do I not already stand here wet with your misery and drenched like a dog? Now do I shake myself and run away from you, that I may again become dry. Thereat may you not wonder. Do I seem to you discourteous? Here, however, is my court. But as regards the higher man, well, I shall seek him at once in those forests. From thence came his cry. Perhaps he is there, hard beset by an evil beast. He is in my domain. Therein shall he receive no scath. And verily, there are many evil beasts about me. With those words, Zarathustra turned around to depart. Then said the soothsayer, O Zarathustra, you are a rogue. I know it well. You would fain be rid of me. Rather would you run into the forest and lay snares for evil beasts. But what good will it do you? In the evening will you have me again. In your own cave will I sit, patient and heavy like a block, and wait for you. So be it, shouted back Zarathustra as he went away. And what is mine in my cave belongs also to you, my guest. Should you, however, find honey therein, well, just lick it up, you growling bear, and sweeten your soul. For in the evening we want both to be in good spirits. In good spirits and joyful, because this day has come to an end. And you yourself shall dance to my lays as my dancing bear. You do not believe this. You shake your head. Well, cheer up, old bear. But I also am a soothsayer. Thus spoke Zarathustra.